Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
And we're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are, people of color in restaurants, and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman. And once again, despite the assurances that were made on the last show, I am alone for this week's introduction. I did not criticize my beloved wife and co-host this week as I did last week, as we revealed on the Mike Solomonoff episode the other day, but rather we're just too busy. I didn't get to edit today's show until about 5 a.m. on Tuesday morning. I'm hoping it'll air Wednesday. It might not air until Thursday or Friday, depending on when Dave can get to the edit. But we literally could not find a time, Caitlin and I, to get together and do the intro. We were ships in the night this week. So this week's guest is Michael LaMonaco. A lot of you might know Michael LaMonaco from television. He was one of the early stars of the television Food Network. He used to have a show called Michael's Place. That was how I first became familiar with him. We met for the first time at the James Beard Awards. I had just written or co-written my first book, The Gotham Bar and Grill Cookbook, with Chef Alfred Portale. And I went up and introduced myself to Michael, and it turned out he had been looking for me. He had wanted to meet me. We ended up collaborating on a book. We wrote a book together called Nightly Specials. But Michael's career is quite extraordinary. He had been an actor in New York City earlier in his life. He is a musician in his personal time. He's a just naturally creative, expressive, soulful guy. And he became known, again, a lot of you probably know this because Michael's a pretty famous dude, but he became known for sort of his take on classic American, I would say, restaurant cuisine, and also to some extent regional cuisine, although that figures less prominently into his restaurant food. But he is a student of food and really knows a lot about the American canon, I guess I would call it. But Michael first rose to prominence at the 21 Club, a restaurant that had been around forever, which he sort of revitalized back in the late 80s and early 90s and made a newly popular, hot, as much as it could be. It's a somewhat exclusive place and remains that. But Michael really got a lot of press when he was there and was sort of this amazing, perfect chef and spokesman for that restaurant. And then he went to Windows on the World, which a lot of you may know because, tragically in hindsight, it was at the top of the Twin Towers. It was on the 107th floor, and obviously was lost in the September 2001 attacks on New York City. Michael was lucky to survive that day. We won't get into all that now. But I've wanted since we started this show to sit down with Michael and talk with him and introduce all of you to him. We got together at Porterhouse, which is his current restaurant, Porterhouse Bar and Grill, which is on the fourth floor of the Time Warner Center, where there's a whole collection of restaurants there. Per Se, Thomas Keller's restaurant is there. Masa, the very well-known sushi restaurant, is up there. Michael and his team now also run something called the Center Bar, which is a bar that's in the common area up there, overlooking the, I guess you'd call it maybe the atrium from the perspective of the fourth floor. And Porterhouse has been around for a little more than 10 years. And over that time, Michael's evolved it. We talk about all of that in this interview. And that's really what I have to say about it. We had lunch together prior to the interview at Porterhouse. I should also mention, I don't reveal this until a little ways into the interview, but I was suffering from an allergy attack, a legitimate allergy attack. I don't mean seasonal allergies. I mean, I believe that I ingested something that was served to me as a mistake. This will be explained in the show, but I mention it now because I sound very stuffy, distractedly so maybe, but I soldiered on and got through the interview, and it's not too bad a distraction, but if you're wondering why I sound like that until I explain it, that's why. And that's it. I think you're really going to enjoy Michael. He's one of my favorite people. I just love him. And just a big, warm, generous guy. And here is our conversation recorded at Porterhouse Bar and Grill Restaurant in New York City a couple of weeks back. I hope you enjoy it. It's gonna take a prolonged arraignment of the senses to make some sense of this. Say that again.
My name is Michael LaMonaco, yes. And I'm thrilled to be here with the author, erudite, bon vivant, and extremely handsome young man.
Young, no less.
Andrew
Friedman.
Not
young anymore, Michael.
Compared to everybody in your book, you're young.
Well, I don't even know how to respond to that. But listen. You know, I was the wunderkind. Do you remember? I was the hot young collaborator at one point, and now I'm 50.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yes.
Can we talk about how you did my PR at Windows on the World?
I didn't, though. The agency I worked for did.
Yeah, but you did it.
No, I didn't.
You weaseled your way into the bar on a regular basis to drink.
And you said,
by the way, I do your PR, and that's why we shouldn't have to charge me. And it went very well that way.
So can we, I don't even consider it a conflict because I'm so compromised already. I showed up here to do this interview. And there was red wine on the table already. And then you seduced me. With what was the lunch we just had? We had a beautiful Porterhouse.
Well, yeah, but you see, not backing up far enough because I just received my copy, signed no less.
Yes.
Of the great new book.
Go ahead.
Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll.
Yes.
And honestly, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
The art, the design, the book, the layout.
Thank you. Fantastic.
So I get the book.
Thank you.
You're coming to do this.
Yes.
And, you know.
It's an Andrew Friedman day for you.
It is.
So you got the book and you thought, I have to make him a Porterhouse.
Well, I knew I had to feed you. That was part of the deal. Like, come and we're going to have some lunch.
Yes.
And I thought, do I have a salad? And I thought, no, some protein. And should we have pasta? No. Porterhouse is our signature cut.
It's we're at the Porterhouse Bar and Grill. But yes. I have to say, first of all, when you say what you had to feed, feeding me is not a condition of my interview.
It's a condition of my being Italian.
You being Italian-American and you being Michael LaMonaco, it is in your nature.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
It's what
I do. It is in your nature to feed your friends. Whenever I come here, it's almost, I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but it reminds me of the way my grandmother used to be. You're like, would you like us? Because you know I love the Sunday here. You know, yes. I love it. And I can come by.
It's on the menu because of you.
I could drop by here at like 6 p.m. and you'll say, would you like a Manhattan? Would you like a sundae? Can I get you a sundae?
Yes.
That is in your nature. You are a loving individual. Well, and you express your love through food.
Well,
that's a cliche, but this is very true of you.
It's one of the joys of cooking is cooking for other people. Now, I have to say, Michael Amirati and Daniel in the kitchen.
You have to explain who these people are.
My sous chefs here.
Yeah.
They're the ones who cooked your lunch today.
Yes.
So,
yes.
But they cooked for me as well. So I appreciate them and I thank them and I send them kudos.
Yes.
But you know, the whole thing is sharing food and in this case wine.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the few great pleasures in life that hasn't been taken away from us yet or adulterated to such a point that it loses its worthiness, because we got to have lunch together before we did this.
Yes.
And we only had one glass of wine. We didn't, we didn't have the bottle. And that was really, you know, that's just delightful in the middle of an afternoon.
It was such a surprise. And I have to say, not to mention the book again, but I am getting ready to go on book tour. And I have been, you don't even know this, but I've been, you know, I've been running 6 miles a day and I've been living on protein shakes and salads and all. Ever since last night when I looked at my book and I was like, okay, I'm going to see Michael tomorrow. And I knew you were going to try to give me lunch, which sounds like it's punishing or something, which it's not. But I was like, I had it all planned out. I'm like, I'm going to have a steak tartare and some kind of salad, right? That was my plan. I was like, I'm going to have some protein. I'm going to have some greens. I'm going to be really good. And then out comes the beautifully carved, sliced, I don't know what you call it, but the platter presentation of the porterhouse, fries and onion rings.
Yes.
So I won't have dinner tonight, but I'm grateful.
Well, you know, we named this restaurant Porterhouse Bar and Grill for the Porterhouse ethos.
What does that mean?
So in on or about early 19th century New York, the bars and grills of New York were basically for sailors and traveling people, working business job, you know, coming off of ships in Manhattan's Lower East Side, down near Fulton Market. And lo and behold, there was a porter house. And they were called porter houses because if you drank porter, you would get the most calories from your drink, which would give you the most energy to lift and haul and bail and load the ships and unload the ships.
Okay.
And porter houses were common in Lower Manhattan. And one of them had a particular cut of meat that they liked to cook, and that was the short loin. And the short loin is where we find the porterhouse steak. And as the tale goes, the meat market guys would label that porterhouse. They labeled that cut, that short loin, porterhouse. And they brought it, and that's where it was cut, and it was a big short loin is where you have the strip and the fillet, and that's what was served along with porter, which was, you know, a richer form of beer, right?
Yeah.
We know what a porter is. So it became known as the porter house cut, and that's where we get the name for that steak. But what's important about it is these were welcoming places. The doors were open to anybody who came through, and there was really the warmth and the conviviality of the table was expressed through cold porter and hot porterhouse steaks.
Now, I need to ask, first of all, a quick aside, because I can't hide it. I don't want to name them. I don't want to get sued. But if I sound nasally today, I had a coffee at a national coffee chain before I came here. And I am convinced, you know this, Michael, I have an almond allergy. And as part of my regimen that I was talking about, I drink soy milk now. And I ordered a soy latte. I'm convinced that I was served a almond milk latte.
Very possible.
Because about 15 minutes after I drank it, you saw me when I came in here. I had hives.
Yeah.
And it's clear. It's lifting.
I've avoided much better now.
I went and bought Benadryl in case I needed a rescue. But I never have these attacks. But anyway, that's an aside. Here's my question. You just gave me this beautifully rendered, and if I didn't mention it in the intro, which I'm going to try to remember, you know, you have this amazing voice. You do great delivery. You were an actor at one point in your life.
Yeah.
But that aside, this beautifully rendered little pocket history you just gave of Porterhouse, did you – you know a lot about food history. Did you know what you just told me when you started – did you learn that somewhere as a younger man? Or when you decided you guys were going to do this restaurant, did you kind of study up on the history of steakhouses in New York, and is that when you learned it? Or was that something that was already in your head, you know, for decades?
Well, it's a little bit of both, but the actual information comes from a book of a book that is really a manual of food purchasing from mid-19th century.
Huh.
And it describes that story that I just told you.
Does it?
In the book.
This was a book put out by a purveyor?
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, well, put out actually to help people purchase food for...
So it wasn't the book for the person from whom you would order it. This was kind of a book that was like
This was like a purchaser's guide of how to spec...
So you know what kind of cut you wanted or...
All kinds of food. Meat, fish, produce.
Really?
Yeah. And so it's a great look at mid-19th century American food and restaurants. And but more than restaurants, it was steamships. The historians will say the steamship hadn't been invented yet. Shipping.
Yeah.
Travel.
Yeah.
The early days of hotels.
Yes.
But also particularly for the mansion crowd.
Yeah.
For the upper crust, people were buying their food and they needed to understand how to buy food correctly. And a book like that would have shown people how to do that. So, but you know, but the food history, I think the love of that concept really comes from Julia Child. And, you know, I was a big fan of Julia.
Books, when, television, both?
Television, when I was in the 60s, when I was a young tyke.
The French Chef.
Fascinated by it. And that's the first book I ever bought as a young adult was a copy of The French Chef.
Okay.
And which was a collection of her television recipes.
Uh-huh.
So, you know.
And this was strictly at the time as a hobbyist.
That's right.
A home cook.
And I think home cooks start... you know, home cooks are important to food overall. Things may happen in restaurants and then bubble up and bubble down to the home cooks.
Yep.
But home cooks also tell us what's important in today's current, you know, in sort of the current society.
How so? How do you learn from, what do you get from a home cook?
So
and how do you get it?
Well, you know, walking through a supermarket, a really good supermarket will tell you, will tell you as much about the dining trends of today as reading menus.
That's interesting. Do you do that periodically?
Yeah, I do. I do. We happen to have a really good one in this building.
In the basement? Well, we're in the Time Warner Center in New York, and amazingly, can I tell you, for all the times I've been to your restaurant, for all the times I've come to Per Se, for either to eat or more often than eating for an interview or an event of some kind, I've never been down there. But there is a Whole Foods in the basement of this building.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. It's like the Batcave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It is. And I watched my mother, you know, just as a kid, my mother shopping for food.
Yeah.
And also we had a home garden and we did home canning and pickling and homemade wine and homemade sausage.
Yeah.
So I think food has always been part of my, you know, it's just been part of my life in a way that being a chef... it really made sense for me to become a chef, to change from acting. You mentioned it, acting. Yeah. You know, theater was something I was passionate about, passionately interested from my early teens until my late 20s. But as a kid, all of those things that we did at home, canning tomatoes every fall, all of the produce that we would buy. We didn't shop in supermarkets. We only shopped in little shops where you could kind of hand select things.
Sure.
And that was Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So when you walk through a Whole Foods today, you see you see the things that people want to eat because they wouldn't have it. They wouldn't be selling it.
That's interesting. So you see it as a dialogue that it goes on between restaurants and home cooks.
Right.
Yeah.
And what you don't...
Because you guys influence, that's been the case for decades. You know, the things that are hot in restaurants, you know, why did people start having sriracha at home? You know, because of guys like David Chang, right? I mean, that's where that started, really. But you're talking about it being a two-way street.
But, well, it is, because if it doesn't resonate at home,
right,
it won't, it, I don't think
it'll be short-lived.
It'll be short-lived in the marketplace, in the restaurant marketplace.
Right.
And maybe we started this talking about steakhouses.
Yeah.
Steak, and this is a beef-centric restaurant. We sell a lot of fish, a great fresh fish, shellfish in Porterhouse, and it's sort of part of the menu is really a broad based menu. But there are steakhouses that are kind of old school in the way that they focus on one or two cuts.
Yes,
we focus on a broader selection.
Yes,
we focus on hormone free, antibiotic free.
But it's not just that. You also, I don't have your menu in front of me, but you do things with the different cuts, right? You have like some of them have certain seasonings on them.
Right, or
certain,
right. Like chili rubbed ribeye.
That's
right.
They're not all just grilled.
And it's not all the prime cuts, It's not, you know, skirt steaks are big, and hanger steaks.
Yeah.
But the beef steak and the beef steak dinner is something you know about. I'm sure many in your audience know that in the turn of the century, the late 19th century, early 20th century, beef steak dinners were political fundraisers. And, they were meant to bring people together. They had great cuts of beef going through the room and, big tankards of beer. And it was really all about political fundraising. But I think that steakhouses kind of keep the pulse of the people. They're very democratic kind of restaurants in the way that they are big and noisy and fun and convivial without being pretentious or precious.
Yeah.
So, and it's something that I think restaurants that serve mainly meat-centric menus are, still do that, but in a different way and in a more inclusive way today.
How does this knowledge, Michael, since I have known you, okay, the way you're talking right now, you seem to know a lot about food, about its history, about where it comes from. I remember having a conversation with you about Castroville once when we were talking about artichokes. I'm talking like 20 years ago when you and I first met. And what I'm curious, and I don't even know if you could put words to it, but how does, and we should say for people who don't know, you were the chef at 21. You were the chef at Windows on the World. You became known for sort of your take on, I guess we would call it American cuisine. You made it very relatable for the modern diner, whatever the modern diner was, I would say from 21 to now. What you do here is very relatable for the 2018 diner who's walking in here. But what I'm curious to know is, how does this knowledge that you have affect your menu composition, affect your dish conception, affect how things are cooked here? It seems to me that this is all such a part of what's going on in your head that it must somehow resonate in the food, but in a way that's not literal necessarily. But am I making sense?
Yeah,
I feel like this stuff has to, in some way, you can't just be reading this stuff for kicks. I feel like this has to show up in some way.
That's a really good take. That's a really good question and a take on kind of like who I feel like I am. So I became a chef. I set out to be a chef in the mid-80s.
Yep.
And there was a lot going on in food, in American food, American kitchens, and very inspiring. Some of them were Europeans, like Wolfgang.
Yep.
Some of them were doing things, that were new in California. I found California to be really an incredible place to visit and read about, you know, to learn about,
Even
back then.
So you weren't one of these East Coasters who had a real sort of New York myopia. Like you were aware of what was going on in the West Coast.
I've long had a love affair with California. Yeah. And kind of fantasized, had my father kept moving west from New York when he came here in 1924, had my family moved west. And the funny thing is when I was a kid growing up, the family next door, next to us, they moved west in the early 60s. For what reason, I don't know.
Yeah.
And they were an Italian-American family. Okay. They moved west. And Italy has California has long been a draw for Italian immigrants and Italian American families for the weather.
Yeah,
I mean, the weather.
The weather, the wine culture.
The wine culture, the food culture, the agriculture.
Yeah.
You see that all throughout Northern California.
Very, especially in the north. Yeah, very comparable.
Exactly. So I wonder, wow, what if we had grown up out there and how? Who would I be today? But what you're saying is very true because about trying to be aware of the longer sense of history of restaurants and food and, you know, going through the constant reinvention. And that's what restaurants, I think, are constantly reinventing themselves. The business is constantly reinventing themselves. And you mentioned David Chang with, you know, David Chang and his generation have reinvented dining in so many ways. Not just the food, but also how it's done, how it's prepared, where you sit, whether it's a counter, how informality has invaded fine dining.
Yes.
And, you know, people have talked about the death of fine dining. What is fine dining?
Yeah.
But all I know is great food is never out of style.
Right.
And great food prepared, well prepared, is never out of style.
Yeah.
So, you know, having some sense of history is good for me as a person.
Yes.
And it's even better for me as a chef. So just there's a great emphasis in the last 20 years, maybe in the last 10 years, on innovation.
Yes.
And so much of restaurant culture for the last 100 years has been on recreating menus and dishes that other people have prepared before.
Uh-huh.
And
Tradition. Yeah.
And reinventing tradition is good. And I think you see traditional dishes reinvented by people like Danielle Ballou. And, you know, you see Danielle doing classic food, but reinvented.
Yeah.
Reinvented for his table.
Yes.
For his marketplace and with his staff. And
totally.
I think that's something that attracted me to cooking is the idea of being also an interpretive artist rather than. And that's what I would say that my kind of cooking is.
Yes.
Interpretive cooking of, you know, interpretive cooking rather than innovative. I wouldn't really.
Well,
I don't.
You made an analogy once when we were talking, which you may or may not remember it. But, you know, you were talking about young cooks. And that the hardest thing to teach a young cook, because cooking is, especially if you're a line cook, it's repetitive tasks, right? And what you were saying about cooking sort of classic dishes, you made a comparison to a composer. Not to a composer, to a conductor, right? So you can have a classical piece of music, but your arrangement of it, right, that the slight differences that make your arrangement your own was analogous to cooking, right? So you might take a classic dish, you, Michael LaMonaco, you may not even change the composition of ingredients, but the slighted the ratios, the seasoning, the way how far you take something in terms of doneness or right, these are things that will make those things your own. That's the soul of your food.
Yes.
Even if you're doing a menu of completely classic preparations that everyone has known the name of forever.
Yes.
Right?
I think that it's important to be able to cook with broad experience.
Uh-huh.
So when I set out to be a chef, I wanted French cooking as my background.
Yes.
I wanted classic training.
Yeah.
As much as you could get it.
Yeah.
And although some people say you can't learn cooking in school, I think that schools can teach a lot. In our system of education, a school can be the closest we get to a good apprenticeship.
Right.
And we know of chefs who've had bad apprenticeships.
Sure.
Who've been, you know, beaten and and scalded in their So a good apprenticeship gives you all the tools you need to succeed on the line in the next restaurant.
Right.
And having a broad sense of experience, a broad set of experiences can help a conductor approach a new orchestra in a new way, even if it's a classic piece of music, and be able to find the nuance and keep it fresh for the audience and have them feel as though they've never heard it played better or never heard it played this way.
Yes.
I think that cooking for people is very much a very creative life to lead.
Yeah.
And part of that is knowing what came before and being able to take those tools and use them to reinvent the dishes and the food that you're cooking today. So I'll just say this. So while Porterhouse may be a meat-centric restaurant, what we focused on when we opened in 2006 were the quality of the ingredients, the sourcing of the ingredients, and the freshness of our cooking. So that, I mean to say, you know, all of our produce is fresh produce. All of our produce comes from the best sources we can get, and we try to go organic. We don't always go we can't always find organic. Yeah. We try to go local. We can't always find local, but we're always using the best fresh ingredients, and that is different from many steakhouses.
Sure. Yes.
Many use, you know, not the best ingredients around the beef.
Yes, right.
The beef might be great, but everything else around the beef is the cheapest, the fastest, the easiest, the frozen where they do it.
Yeah.
But so, you know, we just tried to approach meat and meat-centric cooking as though it was the finest fine dining we could make it out to be.
Well, it's almost like an auteur, like in film terms, like an auteurist view of things, right? Like if you're an auteur, this is one of the things that's always defined your cooking. And now you've applied it to this, I hate to use the word concept, but to this concept, to this restaurant, right?
Right. We didn't want to be like anybody else.
Right, right. So I have a question, though, Mike. You know, we started this interview by talking about this Italian-American quality of yours, this generous spirit of yours. Am I mistaken or is this accurate? I feel like it wasn't really until this restaurant, and I don't even think necessarily when it first opened. I mean, like currently, in the last several years, I feel like you have brought your Italian-American-ness onto the menu in a way that I don't think you did in the past. I don't think you did. I never ate at 21 when you were there. I don't remember this being a factor that much at Windows. You know, there's a few pastas.
Yeah.
There's a risotto. There's, what do you call it, the cream spinach, Mr. Pete's way?
Yeah,
who's Mr. Pete?
Well, so
I envision Mr. Pete as some guy you knew in Brooklyn or something.
So this speaks to your noting my reverence for history. But that's Pete Crindler, or Crindler, as some people would say.
Yeah.
And he was one of the original owners of 21.
Oh,
so 21's long history.
All right.
Crindler and Burns were the two, they sound like a comedy duo, but they were the two families that invented 21, that opened 21 in 1929. They opened it, and Pete Crindler and Jerry Burns were cousins. And I worked with them in my days at 21.
Got it.
They were owners emeritus.
Okay.
They no longer owned it,
but
they had offices there at 21, were in the dining room greeting their friends. And so I had a lot of contact with them. So Mr. Pete, that's what we called him.
Yeah.
All the employees called him that. He loved his cream spinach with some chopped bacon in it.
Uh-huh.
And when I put that on the menu,
yeah.
One of the first people I invited in 2006 to come here and see the joint, have some dinner, was Jerry Burns.
Oh, wow.
At the age of 99.
Okay.
Jerry came to dinner with his daughter, his wife.
Wow.
Yeah. Came to dinner, and he scanned the menu, and he gets to that, and he said, "Why is Pete on the menu and I'm not?" I said, "Jerry, everything else is you."
That's everything so else.
So their sense of conviviality, Pete was a bon vivant.
Yes.
And Jerry was a real operations guy. I actually think I learned a lot from them about hospitality.
Yeah, that's great. But how about the rest of it? I feel like you earlier talked about, American cuisine, right? So I think in the time you came up, American cuisine, I think it meant two things, right? Like martini, right? A martini means two things. There's actually what a martini is. It's a gin drink, sometimes made with vodka. Classicists would say it's only made with gin. But then there's all these other martinis that aren't really martinis, right? American cuisine to me in the 80s came to mean, so there were two things. There was the melting pot cuisine that had Italian, a million influences, anything goes. But then there was the American cuisine, and I put you in this group, of a Patrick Clark, of a Charlie Palmer, of a Larry Forgione, stuff that very much was American reference points, very American in character. You looked at it and you said, that is fancy American food.
Compliment. That's great. Thank you.
Yes, but I don't think of you back then. I don't think of the Italian-American piece as part of it at that time. I feel like that is something that you more recently that's been part of, strangely, of your evolution, is coming back to your own personal history.
So,
which I feel like you used to submerge out of deference to the larger sort of American thing.
Well, also, just going back to that time in my life where I was an actor, you submerge yourself in a character.
Right.
And the character that I submerged myself in was American cooking.
Yeah.
But also for me, in that was Americana. Americana cooking.
That's interesting. What does that mean to you?
The regional cooking.
Yeah.
Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah.
New England.
Yes.
Deep South.
Yes.
New Orleans. Those foods and flavors meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
As a guy in my early 20s, where I was traveling a lot around the country, and I was really getting to see a lot of parts of the this country.
Yes.
And eat those foods.
Yeah.
And I stored a lot of that away in my food memory. And have tried to recreate some of them, including a gumbo, a great gumbo. And, that kind of thing comes back to me. My first job out, and I think also training helps you to understand. So culinary school helped me to understand the elements of these dishes that I had remembered from 10 years before.
Uh-huh.
But my first job while I was going to school, I went to New York City Technical College for, they called it hospitality, restaurants and hospitality. The restaurant program was, Patrick Clark went there himself.
Uh-huh.
While I was in school and for a while afterwards, I was cooking in an Italian restaurant. My first job was in an Italian restaurant, Monty's Venetian Room. In Brooklyn.
Yes.
Right next to the Gowanus Canal.
I was going to say, that was a Gowanus. Yeah.
A Gowanus Canal restaurant.
Yeah.
And 100 years there. The restaurant was there for 100 years. It's still kind of open. There's something going on there. I don't know. But but in my day, it was Monty's Venetian Room. And it was a classic Brooklyn Italian-American restaurant on the higher end, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
A little, not fancy, but fancy people went there.
Not where you'd go for like a weeknight bite.
Well, a lot of people did. It was a very, very well-known restaurant in its day.
Yeah.
So it was the place where, Sinatra would take a run out to Brooklyn. He ate there.
Yeah.
A Sunday night, we always had... we always had a crowd on Sunday night that were real regulars from Manhattan that would come out to Brooklyn to eat Italian food in Brooklyn, Monty's Venetian Room. So I learned a lot about my own Italian-Americanness.
Yes.
I grew up in an Italian-American home that kind of thought about Sicilian food a lot.
Yeah.
And Sicilian country cooking and offal.
Yes.
We ate a lot of offal and different cuts of meats and fish. stews and things like that, that besides the homegrown vegetables. But the Italian-American food that we were cooking out there in Brooklyn was pretty authentic to that world, that maybe mid-century world of Italian-American cooking.
Did you, though, as a cook coming up at that time, knowing as you did about the goings-on in American restaurants, you talked about California, knowing the goings-on across the river in New York City, knowing the goings-on at the River's Edge at the River Cafe, did you accord the same respect to the Italian-American food, the food you were cooking at that restaurant, as you did to those other things? Or did it seem a rung down on the ladder to you of restaurant cuisine?
Well, no, actually, I held it in actually quite high esteem.
You did.
For the food that it was.
Yeah.
And it might have been, you know, veal saltimbocca. And,
right.
You know, we were, you know, with those dishes that we were making, I think were very classic.
Yeah.
From another time, I did have my sights set on Manhattan.
Yeah.
And for a kid who grew up in Brooklyn,
yeah,
we called it the city.
Uh-huh.
So there I was living right in Brooklyn. Yeah. I was going to school in Brooklyn. I was working in Brooklyn. Yeah. So it kind of all made sense.
Yeah.
But like Tony Manero.
I was just going to say, like Saturday Night Fever. Yeah.
I had my sights on the city.
Yeah.
And when I could get, you know, when I could get over that bridge, the Brooklyn Bridge.
So funny you celebrate just said that. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah,
I,
that's the
you know,
comparison, totally.
And when I was at Monty's, Nick Monty was this great guy, gregarious owner. They wanted to send me to the city. They wanted me to go work at some of those Italian restaurants that were northern Italian restaurants here in Manhattan, which in the 80s was a big thing.
Yes.
Northern Italian.
Yes.
No Italian, no gravy, no tomato sauce.
Yeah, yeah.
It was butter and cream. And actually, that wasn't what I had in mind. What I had in mind was a restaurant like La Côte Basque and Le Cirque. Those are the things that I thought I could find the next level of training that I wanted.
Yep. Okay, we're going to take a break. Before we do, this is just a quick reminder to everybody. I'd love if you followed the show on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. The handle is @ChefPodcast. That's @ChefPodcast. And if you would like to subscribe, you can do that on Stitcher or iTunes. And if you would like to leave us a rating or a review at Apple's iTunes Store, we'd really appreciate it. It really does help people find the show, and we'll be right back. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a penny bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel, Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
And we are back, and I will get you back to our interview with Chef Michael LaMonaco of Porterhouse Bar and Grill in just a moment. But I did first want to mention this Thursday, this show may or may not have dropped by Thursday, but this Thursday, April 12th, I'm getting on an airplane, or I may be on an airplane when this drops, or I may have just arrived on the West Coast when this drops, but I am headed on an 11-day swing through Southern and Northern California. The express purpose of the trip is to promote my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. That is my newish book about the American chefs of the 70s and 80s. I hope you all will read it, maybe review it online somewhere. It's available everywhere that you can get books, both on the internet and in person and in all formats. It's available electronically. It's available in hardcover. It's available on Audible. And I am going to be doing a series of
talks of my own, panel discussions, events that other people have invited me to because I have a book currently out. The first ones are going to be in Los Angeles this Saturday, April 14th, at 10:30 a.m. I will be giving a talk to the Culinary Historians of Southern California. The subject of the talk is chefs versus owners in 1970s and 1980s Los Angeles. There is a huge chapter in my book called New World Order that describes what I see as the flipping of the template from a owner-dominated world to a chef-dominated restaurant world. And I'll be talking about that. The event is free. You can just show up. It's at the Los Angeles Central Library at 630 West 5th Street in Los Angeles. And the other event I'm doing on Saturday, also in Los Angeles, is a conversation and book signing with Russ Parsons, the former LA Times food editor and columnist, now serving as a sort of newish, I think they're only about 5 or 6 months old, culinary shop, primarily a bookshop, although they have other wares for sale. And they're in Chinatown. The owners are just the loveliest people. I stuck my head in there not long ago to say hello. And next thing I knew, we had scheduled this event, but there's going to be wine at this event. Russ and I are going to have a conversation, and there's going to be a book signing. There's also a book signing at the library after my culinary historians talk. So those are both happening this Saturday, April 14th. You can see all the information you need on my website, Toqueland, TOQUELAND.com/appearances. So if you go there, you will see listings of all these events, as well as the events I'm doing in San Francisco in the day or two following my appearances in LA. I'm going to be, among other places, at Omnivore Books Monday night, the beloved culinary bookstore, 6:30, Monday, April 16th. I will be there talking and signing books. And then on Tuesday, the 17th, I will be with David Kinch, the 3-star Michelin chef of Manresa Restaurant, and we will be at the Diesel Bookstore in Larkspur. Okay? And then I'm going to the World of Flavor Conference in Napa. I am working really hard to get the word out about this book. I'm very proud of it, and I hope if you guys are in California, you'll come see me. I'm also going to be at the San Francisco Cooking School. That event is largely filled, but that's on the 15th of April. And then I'll be back in LA for the LA Times Festival of Books on Saturday, the 21st. Again, this is all on my website, Toqueland, TOQUELAND.com/appearances. And you can find out everything you need to know there. Otherwise, as always, I hope if you're a first-time listener, if you just haven't gotten around to it, that you will follow the show so that you can keep up with news about appearances and about new episodes as they drop. I am on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. The handle is @ChefPodcast. Really easy to remember, @ChefPodcast. Please follow the show so that you can see these things and subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher. That's the easiest way to keep up. And as always, if you would like to write a review or even just leave us a rating, which takes 2 seconds on iTunes, it really does help people find the show. And I, as listeners know, appreciate it and love it. I check all the time to see if we've gotten a new review. It makes me feel very warm inside. Anyway, with that, I am going to return you all to my conversation. As we get toward the end, finally my allergy is lifting and I sound a little better. My conversation with the great and wonderful Chef Michael LaMonaco, my buddy, at Porterhouse Bar and Grill in New York City. Here you go. Michael, can you speak to me about this facility where we are?
You mean this restaurant?
No, I mean the Time Warner Center. Oh. I mean, being across the street from Central Park, being in Midtown Manhattan, this bustling Midtown Manhattan, where it's always busy, where it's especially insane during the holidays. What's it like for you? You've worked in a lot of different parts of New York. What is it like to be in this neighborhood? Forget the Time Warner Center. I mean, that's not news anymore.
Yeah, no,
what's it like being just smacked? I mean, this is kind of the heart of the city right here.
Yes, I agree. You're right. I think it is very much an important hub.
Yeah.
Columbus Circle.
For people who don't know, we should say Columbus Circle exists at the southwest corner of Central Park. And Midtown Manhattan, there's half the subway lines in the city converge several floors down from where we are right now.
Yes.
It's one of the hubs of the city. It really is.
And it's become more so over the years because a lot of new buildings have gone up, residential buildings. Yes. There's been a lot of business development.
Yeah.
There are new schools in this neighborhood.
Yeah.
Colleges. There are a few college campuses, urban college campuses right here within walking distance. Important high schools are here. It's become a very much a central part of New York life.
Yeah.
And people are here passing through the building every day. Now, you talked about this. I'm in the shops at Columbus Circle. This is a destination dining location that no one could have predicted would be the success it is. And to say that, originally on this location was the Coliseum. The Coliseum was an event space where they had the car show every year when I was a kid and the boat show.
Yeah.
My father used to bring me to both of those things. And so this was a real... This was a real active location.
And that was a name that had a spillover, right? Like there was Coliseum Books and there was...
A Coliseum Bar.
Coliseum
right across,
Bar.
It's still there.
And, you know, yeah, like that was... The there had to be a Coliseum Diner. There had to be.
Yeah.
That was a presence that defined the neighborhood to some extent.
Yeah, in the 60s and the 70s, you knew about this.
Yeah.
And then when this building... replaced the Coliseum, this building being the Time Warner Center.
Yeah.
More specifically, we're in what's a shopping center, right? There are stores all around me.
Yeah.
In this is called the Shops at Columbus Circle.
Yeah.
And my partner is Kenneth Himmel. Ken Himmel, I've known for many years. He is a developer. He is a restaurant owner in Boston. And even when I was at 21, I knew Ken. And we spoke about this in the early 2000s, 1999. He talked about this building.
Yeah.
And what I'm getting to is the restaurant collection. That's what he called it.
Uh-huh.
And we have Per Se here.
Heard of it.
And we have another fine dining spot called Masa.
Heard of it.
And... those were, and they remain, really the anchors to this restaurant collection.
Yeah.
And the idea was that the restaurant collection offered a variety of dining options in this urban center.
Yeah.
There are people who live in this building, very high-end people, they don't even let me go up the elevator to that section where they live. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a fancy hotel here, the Mandarin Hotel.
Yeah.
But you also have all this shopping. And so that's sort of a new part of New York City. You know, the idea that people would travel to my restaurant on the fourth floor is new to New York City dining.
Yeah. Well, when you guys opened, that was a big, I remember that. I mean, that was a big thing.
Right. Because New Yorkers like it dark and out of the way, street level.
Yeah, this was not that different from the challenge that is presented or used to be presented to hotel restaurants. That's another thing that used to be a real challenge. You mentioned at the beginning of this interview my semi-secret life as a publicist in my past. But when people came to us like, oh, we're going to be a new restaurant in a hotel. I mean, this for me was in the 90s. We were like, oh, my God, it didn't matter who it was. That was such a challenge.
Absolutely.
But that's less so now.
And you mentioned the Central Park right across the way. So from the windows of my dining room, you can sit and have dinner and see Central Park.
Yes.
You can see the cityscape of the east side.
Yes. And
it's a beautiful location. It's a beautiful room. And honestly, it was an attraction to me. That attracted me. a beautiful dining room facing Central Park. Seems like there aren't a lot of those.
Yes.
And I had my chance to have one, and this is it.
Yeah.
And being able to take my approach to American food, my approach to Americana, and do a meat-centric restaurant seemed like a great fit. And over time, I was able to incorporate more of myself into it, like some, you know, carefully made pasta or some risotto, or we do a veal chop that has gnocchi, very much like you would find in a northern Italian restaurant in the old days, a great veal chop. But this is great natural veal, you know, with homemade gnocchi.
I had a dish here, Michael. It was, I guess maybe you were out of town. I don't remember. Was it a pork chop with pepperoncini?
Homemade hot pepper, home pickled hot peppers.
Yes. Well, what do you call that dish?
So it's a heritage pork chop.
Yes.
With hot peppers.
Yes.
And broccoli rabe.
Yeah.
You can't get more Italian American than that.
But that dish, man, I love that kind of food.
Vinegar peppers.
Yes.
We call
with
them.
Vinegar peppers. Yeah.
Vinegar peppers.
Yeah.
But it's a heritage pork chop.
See, that's what I was alluding to before when I said I feel like you have made room for this part of yourself.
Yes.
In a way that you did not years ago.
Yes. So part of that really comes in the last few years, integrating my, you know, just my love of food, all kind of food, into this menu. But also in 2 years ago, we did a renovation of the restaurant for our 10th anniversary. We did a really
beautiful.
Thank you. But a major renovation. Yeah. We planned it for a year. We closed for 5 weeks.
Yes.
We redid all kinds of, you know, floors and surfaces. We kind of refreshed the restaurant.
You did not change the footprint of the restaurant.
No, but we refreshed.
Yes, new color scheme.
Yes.
Yeah.
New tabletop.
Yes.
And new menu. New menu design, newer menu ideas.
Uh-huh.
And part of that is reflected in dishes that you name.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, for me,
it's fun.
It's fun, but it's also, to me, it's, again, I feel like you, in a way, as you've gotten, I don't even want to say older, you're not old, but as you've matured, I feel like you have found, again, I think there's so many, I know a lot of chefs, we've talked about it on this show with a lot of people, hate the comparison between cooking and art, okay? But I do feel that there is a comparison between chefs and artists in that I see a lot of analogies to writing. You find ways of weaving your self, of your voice. Your voice changes, right? Your voice on the plate.
Well, writers want to find their voice, right?
Right. But that can be these subtle little things where your personality in a more effortless way is manifested in the writing, right? And I feel like for you, you have found a way, and what very much started to me, I connected this restaurant when you opened it, in your own way, but as part of a very big steakhouse thing that was happening, a moment.
Right.
And, you know, now it's very pointedly called Porterhouse Bar and Grill, not Porterhouse Steak, not right? And you've broadened what this place is very purposefully. But you've also, to me, it's become more personal, but in a way that's like a good record album. Like it's seamless. You know, these dishes we're talking about, the risottos, the pastas, the pork chop with the vinegar peppers, they fit on the menu with the cowboy steak and the porterhouse and the it all seems of a piece. But you couldn't really put words to why. It just feels like it all hangs together well.
And I think that's really nice because that's your view of it is very true, and I don't get to see it that way as frequently as maybe I should, but it is a gut thing. Like, what do I want to eat? What would I enjoy having in this restaurant? And also we did change our name a little bit to Porterhouse Bar and Grill. The food is a grill. It's more than a steakhouse. That's a kind of a fine line, but it is an American grill more than a steakhouse.
Yes.
And the bar is a reference to our great bar, our classic cocktails, and also our rather extensive wine collection and wine list.
Yes.
And the wine program itself. Now, we have some great people here, you know, and the team has really done a job of integrating all of this together. So we also have quite a number of Italian wines on the list.
Yeah.
And so it gives people more options than maybe another restaurant they might be considering in sort of the same vocabulary, you know, of a great steakhouse or in New York. So we have more options for more people, and we do have a big dining room to fill in the sense that, it's a big dining room. It is a large dining room, but we also are very happy to see large tables and not everybody wants the same thing. So giving people more options, I think, is hospitality.
Uh-huh.
It's hospitable. Vegetarians and vegans can find something like the risotto that you talk about. That's a vegetarian dish.
Right.
Yeah. It can be vegan if we leave out the butter.
Yeah.
But we make a vegetable stock just for the risotto.
Okay.
So we make, but that's just in trying to acknowledge that we are in the business of, you know, service is what we do.
Yeah.
And making people happy is what I want to do.
Well, it's really funny because this is an odd thing, and this may be my last question. So maybe it's odd, but maybe it's not. You know, I remember years ago when I was still a PR guy, I was sitting in a meeting for a new restaurant. They said, come sit in on this meeting. You might, you know, find it interesting. You might learn something. And I went, and it was with the designer. And they were talking about chairs, right? And the guy who was going to be the general manager of the restaurant said, in my opinion, the perfect chair for a restaurant is a chair that is unbelievably comfortable for 90 minutes and then becomes immediately uncomfortable, right? Because you want to turn the table. But I have to say, our mutual friend, Michael White, chef, who was right across the way at Marea, made this comment to me once. He's a regular here. And he said to me once, he goes, you know, I love Porterhouse. Michael's great. The food. He was listening. He said, it's also the most comfortable restaurant in New York. Now,
what a nice thing to say.
I had never thought about it, Michael, but you and I have been sitting here. We had lunch.
Yes.
Now we're doing an interview. We've been in these chairs for a while. I could sit here another 2 hours. This is a weird question, but.
Deliberate.
It is.
It is deliberate because my partner, Ken, is very convinced that comfort is part of the experience.
Yeah.
And this is something we talk about a lot, even as we begin to work on some new project together at Hudson Yards.
Yes.
Even as we talk about that, the chairs are one of the main topics.
So interesting.
Finding the right and appropriate chair. So being comfortable is a part of it. Now, let's talk about 21 for a second.
Okay.
Because those were some of the most uncomfortable chairs.
Oh, I wouldn't know.
Well,
I'm not.
But they're just bent wood.
I was a poor college student when you were there.
They're just bent wood chairs, you know? And in fact, they're like cafe chairs you might see at a cafe in Paris or Rome, like on the sidewalk. Very simple. And I'm not knocking their chairs. I'm just saying the profile of the restaurant and how it fits. So, you know, comfort for us is something, you know, how people feel in a room is as important. You know, it's one of the important factors in your overall experience.
Sure.
And a lot of our contemporary restaurant, you know, chefs today, that may not be at the top of the list.
Yeah.
And, you know, the food is, you know, and the food may be first and, you know, anything else might fall way down the list. But really the concentration on kitchen and creativity, artistry.
Yeah.
You know, what you were saying before about chefs not wanting to equate themselves with artists.
Yeah.
There are chefs who do.
For sure.
View their work in that way. And that's a particular and specific kind of a restaurant experience.
Yeah, which is legitimate.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, there are restaurants about which I say, and I don't even mind saying them, I don't consider it an insult. It's some of my favorite things. You know, a restaurant like a Terra in New York City, you know, that is a restaurant, at least when Matt Leitner was the chef there, and I talked to him once in an interview about this, that's not where you go for a business dinner. That is a restaurant where you go with fellow food enthusiasts, with the idea that you are going to talk about what you're eating.
That's it.
That's it.
You're
and
sitting
that's
at
a totally legitimate genre of dining. I happen to, with the right crowd, my wife is not one of these people, but with the right people, with a chef, with a fellow writer, with a quote unquote foodie, that could be a fun evening.
Right. And, you know, that is all part of the same business, which makes it so much fun to cook in New York because there's such a broad range. But now all over the country, you have such a broad range of dining options that just ups the game for everybody.
Well, I've always said this, you know, I used to be in the film business and one of the things I always loved about movies was, you know, I was going to say a Bergman film, but let's talk contemporary. So like a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, an X-Men movie, Lady Bird, and some schlock horror, Saw 7, right?
Yes.
Those are all movies.
They were.
They're all movies. Yes. But all these things we're naming are all restaurants. Yeah. And I think the breadth of that I really do. I think it's something to be embraced. I think there's a place for all of it.
And that's how you have a street like 46th Street or Restaurant Row in New York City, or a building like this with multiple dining options where we have a restaurant collection. They're all different.
Yes.
And that's the important thing. Yeah. Everyone really should differentiate themselves as much as possible. And that makes it more, and that is what, speaking to what you just said, putting my own personality or my own personal stamp on it is just important to what we do.
Yeah.
And then being able to explain that to the 140 people who work here and, you know, the 50 people who work in the kitchen and suits, you know, just getting that done every day, those are the real joys and challenges of restaurant ownership.
Great. Michael, thanks for making the time.
A great lunch. Thank you for talking to you.
Thanks for coming. The lunch.
Yeah, it's great to have you.
And
thanks for taking
I'm
the
now
going
to go walk back to Westchester to burn it off.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. And that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed spending some time with Michael, as I did. I hope my nasally problems were not too distracting. It wasn't that bad, but it probably sounds worse than it was. And as I've mentioned on recent episodes, I have quite a backlog of shows that we banked in anticipation of me being on the road. So I think you'll be seeing another one as quickly as I can shoot it over to David and as quickly as he can edit it. David Tatasciore, as always, thank you for being our engineer and for splicing these things together. Caitlin, who's usually my co-host, thanks for being willing, even if we couldn't find the time. Hopefully we'll get one more in with you before I get on that airplane. And all of you, thanks for listening. And please, if you are based in or will be visiting California in the next week or so, again, starting Saturday, April 14th through Saturday, April 21st, I will be in various locations in the Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Napa areas. All of that's on my website, Toqueland. toqueland.com/appearances. And you can find out what you need. And if you need tickets, you can find links. Although a lot of these events are free and open to the public. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you back real soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.